Hello, Tom here. Before we start the show, I just wanted to play you in with a little bit of atmosphere, a little bit of slow radio, perhaps. And that Atmos is from Bespoked, the hand-built bike show, which was my destination for this month's episode. So stick around for that. But first of all, here I am with Lizzie.
You are listening to Service Course by the Cycling Podcast, powered by Super Sapiens, energy management for committed athletes and coaches.
Hello, I'm Tom Wally, and I'm with Lizzie Banks for the next hour.
Record.
Lizzie, are we paying you 75 grand for this hour?
Unfortunately not, but that is the speculated amount that it will cost you if you want to buy Ganna's new 3D printed titanium Pinarello track bike. Now, this is pure speculation, which obviously, you know, we're just going straight in with the speculation today on this. You know, Ganna last week, I'm sure you'll all know by now, absolutely smashed the previous record on the track for the hour record, which was previously owned by Dan Biggar, who went and got that record only in August. And Ganna was on this really hyped up new prototype frame from Pinarello, but it was actually the same frame that Dan Biggar rode back in August. And the interesting thing about this is that it was a prototype.
Is that legal at the moment? I didn't know the rules about prototypes, whether things had to be commercially available.
Well, exactly. That is exactly right, Tom. So there are different rules for different events. And before Ganna and Biggar went to go and ride this hour record, there wasn't a rule about prototype bikes being ridden. But after Ganna did his attempt, the UCI have changed their rules and they have brought in a new rule for the prototype equipment as of January the 1st, 2023. Any equipment in development phase and not yet available for purchase must be subject of an authorization request to the UCI equipment unit before its use. So now this is speculation that Pinarello have said that it's available for €75,000. But a similar thing happened with the British Cycling track bike, the Lotus track bike, which we talked about back in, I think, February 2020. And that bike was available to purchase for a hell of a lot of money, but it just so happened that the lead time was going to be until just after the Olympic Games. And this is quite a common thing. But now the UCI have ruled out allowing the use of prototypes in the hour record attempt. So it's been an interesting week in the world of track cycling.
It's been an interesting week in the world of Dan Biggar, because he's only gone and again, sort of low-key, I'd missed this. I didn't, because a lot of the talk about Dan Biggar has been, you know, why don't Team GB make more use of him? You know, why is he not part of the pursuit squad? He is part of the pursuit squad now, and he's just won a gold medal.
He is, and he's just got married also to Joss Loudon, also professional cyclist, last Friday. Congratulations, Joss and Dan. And then flown over to Paris for the Track World Championships, and he was part of the gold medal winning team there. And that was interesting in itself, because of course Ganna had just come from this absolutely phenomenal record, putting 1.2 kilometres into the previous record over the hour. And I think Italy, who are such a good track, you know, team pursuit team anyway, they were expected to win, and they were just pipped to the line by the British team. So it's really, really exciting to see, you know, both Dan Biggar in that team and the influence that he's got on that team. And I wonder how much of his expertise they're using as well. It's a very, very interesting thing, because obviously he works for Ineos Grenadiers, and he also works for the Danish team, who were third at the World Championships. So, I'm not sure where the conflict of interest comes in, but congratulations to Dan for his marriage and being on the podium at the World Track Championships.
No, it is extraordinary. I think the one thing I took away from looking at Ganna's bike, you know, this 75 grand sort of dream machine, the interesting thing, it was on clincher tyres. So obviously, I mean, they've worked out that clincher tyres were fastest.
I think it's quite common, actually, that clinchers with latex tubes are very, very fast. But like you said, they will have tested everything. And one thing that I thought was really interesting that I actually spotted from one of their promotional videos on the day that, Ghana was doing the attempt was they had the promotional video of the bike and they were using images from the wind tunnel testing. And of course, we saw this British Cycling Lotus track bike with these flared forks and flared seat stays. And we sort of wondered whether it would be the start of a trend of when people created new frames, if they would go to these wider, sort of wider winged forks and seat stays. And on the video, although what Pinarello have created is in fact an incredibly slim bike, so slim in fact that the forks and the seat stays, you can barely see any light between them and the wheels, the Princeton Carbon Works wheels that Ineos Grenadiers have been using for a while now. But on the video, they had these, I would say even more extremely winged arms that they were adding to the bike to test in the wind tunnel. So they've obviously tried both of these and decided that actually the narrow, you know, this incredibly narrow bike is the fastest.
I love all this stuff. In fact, this week I was speaking to someone, I can't reveal his name, but he describes himself as working in the shadows of cycling. And there is this group who sort of live in the shadows. Often associated with things like 3D printing, who are just making little bespoke things happen that are then having very sort of big effects. It's fascinating.
Is this Henry Furness who we've already had on the podcast?
This is not, but it's not. But also, you know, we've spoken to a few of these sort of secret squirrel types. But it is sort of fascinating what sort of happens behind the scenes and the way that it's these characters who then try and influence the big brands to sort of to make these changes, because big brands are actually quite reluctant to change the materials, for instance, they're using or their methods, you know. So, yes,
exactly.
I'm fascinated by the dark arts behind this stuff.
Creating new models, if you're doing a carbon frame, is incredibly expensive. And so obviously creating a 3D printed titanium frame is an expensive process. But if you can do that, and if you, you know, if you have the wherewithal to do that, and you're able to see that that is going to be a very successful frame, then you know that it's worth creating the mold for the carbon frame to replicate it on you know, a larger mass-produced scale, or at least on the scale where you can provide it to national teams and things. But it's interesting as well, because there are so, you know, both Bigham's and Ghana's record attempts were so intricately controlled. And I don't know if you watched both of them, Tom.
Well, do you know what? I did. So with Ghana, I just got the kids to bed and I was like, I'll just go and check how Ghana's doing. You know, when you watch the hour record, it's normally, the commentators are normally quite tense. It's subdued because it's often very close whether they're going to break the record or not. And I think I'd got there with about 10 minutes to go. And everyone was so, you know, they were just speculating how much he's going to break it by, because effectively he'd already broken the record by that point, you know.
He just had to stay on the bike, didn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, it's really interesting. So the thing is about Bigham's attempt, and I think we already spoke about this on the podcast before, was the incredibly controlled environment in which he did it.
Yeah.
There was, I wouldn't really call it a crowd, a number of family and friends who were there, and they weren't allowed to cheer until the end of the attempt. We know that people create heat, and when there's a lot of people, they create more heat. That changes both the atmospheric pressure in the velodrome and the, you know, very importantly, the conditions for the rider. And the hotter it is, the less power you're going to be able to put out. And the larger and more excited the crowd, the hotter it gets. So Ghana did have more towards what one might call a crowd at his event. But the crowd was actually briefed by Rod Ellingworth before the event. And they were asked not to cheer until a certain point in the event, because they wanted to make sure that it was very controlled and it was ridden the way that they wanted it to be ridden. And only in that last portion of the ride, when you're really suffering and you just need that boost from the crowd, that's when the crowd was allowed to start cheering. And then in addition to that, there's all of the other scientific data that they had obviously been building up, building in the run up to Dan Bigham's event. And then they were able to look at it and really refine it going into Ghana's attempt. And I just think that, you know, so many people going into this said, of course, he's going to, of course, he's going to make it. But I definitely had doubts. You know, he flew to Australia and back.
Yeah, well, his form hasn't looked great, has it? Because he wasn't great in the time trial at the Worlds, you know, but obviously maybe he'd been focusing on this hour track effort rather than the sort of efforts you need to do on the road. I don't know, but I wasn't super confident in. I mean, yeah, I don't know exactly what his form was like, but obviously it was good enough. I just got the feeling that he could have been even better.
Yeah, no, I agree with you, and I think that, you know, I think it's very difficult because we're always very quick to say if somebody, you know, wasn't good or whatever, but he was still seventh, you know, he was still within a minute of the winner at the World Championships. It wasn't, I would say, a course that is perhaps really suited to him.
Do you mean it doesn't go in circles?
Doesn't go in circles for
with
one
loads
hour,
of banking.
40 minutes. You know, he wasn't in perhaps quite the form that we expect. And flying to Australia and back takes a whole huge toll on your body. You've got, you know, a whole half a day time difference there and then back again. And in addition to that, a lot of people who were attending World Championships actually fell ill. And so, you know, that's a factor that sometimes you just simply can't control when you're on a plane for that long. You're living in an accommodation with, you know, many other people who've come from so many different teams. You know, you've got Swanier's mechanics coming in from different teams as well. So, I have to say I knew that he was physically capable of it, but I wasn't certain that he was going to do it considering the circumstances. And I think that it's really important to take those factors into account. And it then makes the record look even more ridiculously sensational. But he's already said he's not going to be doing it again anytime soon.
Well, I mean, I was going to ask you that. Do you think anyone else is going to do it again anytime soon? Because it sort of looks out of reach a little bit. Yeah. Not just because of the actual distance that he's ridden, but because of the resources that went into it. And there's not, you know, I spoke to Alex Dowsett just the other day, his final race. You know, and he was talking about what he learned from his failed attempt. But there's no way. I mean, he could have gone a lot further had he had the sort of backing that Ganna had. And there's not many riders that can get that backing.
No, absolutely. And when Alex Dowsett did his attempt in Mexico, he spoke about it afterwards, about how much energy went into putting it all together. You know, it was just him and his partner, Chanel, you know, doing all of the organisation for it. And they were having to fundraise all of the money to get there. They were having to do all of the organisation and logistics to get there. They did take a very, very small support crew out there with them. But it's absolutely exhausting doing that. And it was, again, one of the things that struck me when Dan Biggin was doing it was he was just blown away by the level of support that he had there. And he said, you know, I don't even have to cook my breakfast, cook my meals, wash up anything, do my laundry. And I think that we saw that reaction from Dan because he's not used to being in that environment. No. You know, Ganna's used to being in that environment. He's been with Ineos Grenadiers for a number of years and he knows how he gets looked after. So you maybe wouldn't necessarily find those insights after an interview with Ganna because it's just normal for him. And it's only when we hear about it from a rider like Dan Biggin and we could then compare that to Alex Dowsett's experience that you realise that it's just next level. And I often think, actually, when people often talk to me about professional cycling and they say, like, well, don't you just get this done for you? Don't you just get that done for you? It's not quite, you know, how you might think it is. Professional cycling isn't quite as smooth and, you know, maybe well run. Not well run, that's not really the right word, but you don't get as much done for you as you might think, unless you're in a team like Ineos Grenadiers, where they do have the resources to really do everything. The budgets in cycling aren't that big. Even in men's cycling, they're not really that huge, so it is interesting.
We're talking of Ineos, actually. I mean, on your side of things, Lizzie, they are dipping the toe in the water, aren't they, of women's cycling. They've formed a massive
yes,
they've got
absolutely.
A really big team. They've formed a very big team.
they've got a huge team of one. And finally, the signing of Pauline Ferrand-Prévot has been confirmed, which is really exciting because she's the current four discipline world championship holder. I should say,
which is extraordinary. You know,
it is extraordinary
in any sport. That is extraordinary. But you know, what she's done in cycling is you know, yeah, I mean, it's like almost being in boxing, being a four weight world champion or something like that. You know, what she has done is incredible.
It really, I mean, she's one of the all time best. You know, short track, XCO, mountain bike, marathon, and now the gravel world champion. And she, you know, has talent on the road, as we all know. But I think, you know, clearly she just doesn't have the time or, you know, maybe the interest for the road at the moment. But it does kind of pose speculation as to whether Ineos will have a road team in the future. But for now, I mean, it's very much focused on the mountain bike team. And Tom Pidcock has, of course, been racing off-road with Ineos Grenadiers. He's been racing on the mountain bike side as an independent rider. So the school of thought is now that they will register a team for mountain biking and a team for cyclocross. Tom Pidcock has been racing on an unbranded BMC two-stroke and four-stroke. And with Pauline Ferrand-Prevot also coming over from BMC, I wonder if the happy unbranded marriage will continue or whether Pinarello will invest in creating a mountain bike frame. But, you know, you've got two champions there. So you're going to have to... do a nice bit of refining of a mountain bike frame. You know, you can't just put anything out. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there.
I mean, this is just pure speculation. So, I mean, with the men,
the whole speculation, thing has been right? Pure like, speculation. No,
listen,
it?
Like the men's hour record right now seems a little bit out of reach for many at the moment. The women's record is not the same, and there's not been an attempt with the sort of backing that Ineos can give you. Pauline Ferrand-Prevot is probably not going to try an hour record on a 75 grand Pinarello, or would she?
But she probably could.
Could she? I mean, could she?
I think Pauline Ferrand-Prevot is something that could do anything, but I would be very surprised if she went down that route. I do think that there is room for more with the women's hour record. I think that Ellen van Dijk did a stunning job, but I think that she could get more out of herself, perhaps with more training on the track. I think she could hold the line better, and just by holding the line better you can actually go a lot further. I wonder if she had a more controlled environment, like we saw, you know, with the audience, if that would help her, if she had sort of a smoother run. Because she said herself she was very, very nervous. And so perhaps if she went to do that a second time without that pressure, she would go a bit further. And I hope that, you know, with Jos Loudon having done it and then Ellen van Dijk, it will raise the profile of that. And, you know, maybe we'll see a rider like Marlen Reusser go for it. But no, Tom, I don't think we are going to see anybody do it with that sort of level of support that we've seen in the Ineos Grenadiers. They're simply, I mean, I think Trek Segafredo gave Ellen a huge amount of support, but what we see with Ineos Grenadiers is just next level. They have the budget to have the best of everything, the best technical engineers, the best performance, you know, specialists, the best nutritionists, the best biochemists, you know, the best skin suits. They can pay for whatever they want, and they will do. And I just don't think that there's that budget within women's cycling to be able to dedicate that much time and that much resource to it.
Well, Lizzie, I'm going to go and look at some really nice bikes. Have you got any more news before I nip off?
No, that's it for my roundup of Ineos Grenadier news this month.
75 grand an hour Ineos pay, Lizzie, for that. It's incredible.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, and this is Lionel here to tell you that this episode of Service Course is sponsored by Noom, which is an app that I've been using for over a year, and if you've been listening to the cycling podcast, you'll know that I've lost quite a lot of weight. But I suppose when we're talking about weight, we think about the number that shows up when you step on the scales. But actually, it wasn't about the numbers for me when I began, because if you'd asked me back in September 21 what I weighed, I probably would have underestimated by about 10 kilograms. I really had no idea what I weighed. I didn't know the number of calories I was consuming each day. And so as a result, I had no idea that the amount of exercise I was doing, which was a reasonable amount of running and cycling, was just not going to be enough to shift the weight. The balance was all wrong. And I suppose I thought, well, I'm over mid-40s now. That's it, that's me. That weight is just not going to come off. I didn't really realise that there was another way. And Noom has helped show me that there is another way, and I've stuck with it for 13 months simply because I want to stay within the weight where I feel happiest and where running and cycling feel a lot more enjoyable than they did a year ago. And they were already pretty enjoyable then, to be honest. Anyway, the Noom app has had a couple of little changes recently. They've introduced something called Noom Coin, which sounds very interesting. You'll have to sign up to the app to see how that all works, but it's just another incentive to stick with the program. And they've also changed the traffic light coding of different food groups. It used to be red, yellow, and green, but red gives the impression that those types of foods are to be completely avoided. It's a kind of warning sign, isn't it, red? So they've actually changed that to orange. And I think that kind of makes the message more realistic, that not there's no particular food that is completely off limits. And that's certainly a message that I appreciated, because I don't like to be thinking that, oh, I shouldn't be having this type of food, or I shouldn't be drinking this glass of wine or beer. And that's really not the new message at all. I should just say, if you're looking at losing a significant amount of weight, do take medical advice before signing up for Noom or any weight loss program. But certainly I can recommend the Noom approach because it's worked for me and I've been very happy with it. If you'd like to give it a go, go to noom.com/cycle. That's noom.com/cycle, and sign up for your trial today.
So as listeners to this podcast, you'll know that both Lizzie and I adore beautiful looking bikes, as I know that you do. I'm particularly into hand-built and unusual bikes, and that's why for this episode I went to Bespoked, the hand-built bike show. Bespoked is one of the shows I've really wanted to visit ever since we started this podcast, and with one thing and another, particularly the pandemic, I've not been able to go. There's been a couple of years when the show hasn't been on. It returned last year in Harrogate, and this year it took place at the Lee Valley Velodrome in East London. And I went along, and I began with a very strange, unusual and unexpected meeting.
A High Commissioner or Ambassador does many strange things, and we knew about Dan, who's from Namibia. We know that he's a very well-known Namibian cyclist, and in fact my colleague's husband is also a cyclist, and he was very excited to meet Dan as well, so that's why the three of us came here. I'm Linda Scott, I'm the Namibian High Commissioner to the United Kingdom. What's exciting to us about Dan is the fact that he's hand making these bicycles, and so he's basically bringing manufacturing to the country, to his area, which is really, it's on the edge of the desert. It's a little bit remote, but it's the most incredible area. And secondly, he has done a lot for children in his area as well, so he's had cycling schools and all that kind of thing. So what he's doing for the community is incredible. For me, the interesting thing is the area where he comes from, the people who live there, they are very, they have a culture which is centered on cattle. So I love the fact that he's got this sort of cow-like aspect on the bicycle. It's really gorgeous. And I just love the colors. It's really Namibian colors. You see, these are the colors of our flag. So the gold is, as you say, the land, we usually use green as the desert, so that's with the land. So this is the green here. The blue is the sky, and the red is the blood of the people who were shed for our independence. So we only got independence 32 years ago, the same time that the Berlin Wall fell. And that was when we got independence from South Africa. And before that, we were a German colony. What I appreciate about Dan and these bikes is that the people that he works with are from the area, and that really is uplifting the people in the area. And he's really making that little town, which is kind of becoming an artistic focused town, is really, it's growing the focus there. There's a lot, there's water there. It's like a little oasis in the desert. And so it's really exciting to see how this town is moving forward because of Dan.
You have had quite the intro
than quite.
You're interviewing the wrong person. Hi, my name is Dan Craven, also known as Dan from NAM, Namibia, ex-professional cyclist, and now frame builder and, you know, trying to make Onguza bicycles happen.
Take us to your little oasis in the desert, as I've had it described. How's it going out there?
Well, it's becoming really hot. You know, we're already hitting the 40s and summer hasn't even arrived yet. But it's truly, you know, small town on the edge of the desert, as my ambassador said. And, I mean, the workshop is just flourishing. Like, we launched the bikes yesterday for sale globally. But the workshop has been buzzing away for the last, like, 5 years. But the last 5 months has really, like, lifted off. And we've hired a new builder since we last spoke. So we've already got 3 guys with me in the workshop. And it's just, you know, it just gets better and better and better.
Nothing else. You are absolutely repping Namibia. The colours are everywhere. The flag is everywhere. In the brand itself, it speaks Namibia. I mean, you can probably perhaps tell us how you do that.
Thank you. Marry the right woman. So my wife is absolutely amazing, and she's helped so much. Because the colors have to, you know, mean something. And that's part of the reason why we don't do color options. Because the colors speak for us, and the colors represent us in so many ways. Like the first drop of gravel bikes, which is a light hue of a green. I love to call it May, because in the month of May in Namibia, after the rain season, as everything starts to dry out for the very long and dry winter ahead, you see that color everywhere. The funky cow, fork, stem, it's a cow patches, but it's a bright yellow background, is very much, it's so Namibian, because cows are so important to every single culture in Namibia. It doesn't matter what your mother tongue is, cows are important. But the yellow is the bright vibrancy of our people. And most people, if you think of Namibia, it's like, oh, it's the oldest desert in the world. It's the largest sand dunes in the world. We've got the largest population of cheetahs, and we've got wild elephants that don't have a fence around them. But to me, the special thing about Namibia are the people. Like, and if you come from a small town in Namibia like I do, and you go cycling out into the vast expanse of nothingness, which is the meaning of the word, the name Onguza, aka desert, you go out into this vast expanse of nothingness. If you bump into another person on a bicycle, you don't wave or nod. You stop. You go over to them. You start a conversation. And you make a buddy in the middle of nowhere. And that kind of thing doesn't happen elsewhere. You kind of have to go. The further you go into, you know, the depth of the desert, the more you have in common with people that you think you have nothing in common with.
Well, you're there's a road bike just behind us in a sort of very pale sandy colour with the brighter yellow sort of cow print on the forks and on the stem. And it's an absolutely stunning bike. And you're talking about, I mean, it's one of the best looking bikes I've ever seen, quite frankly. You're talking about, you know, the stopping and having conversations. I just wonder what sort of conversations the bikes provoke. I mean, people are now seeing these, I guess, out there in the villages.
Yes. I mean, so do you think that the builders who built these bicycles, I mean, I've known them for 23 years, and they have been doing, I would call it your average job in Namibia, which is not a very high skill, high paying job. But it's the reason I thought this was even possible from the beginning, was because they are so good with their hands. And it's like, if you are good with your hands and you add a little bit of teaching and the proper equipment, you're already there. And so this bicycle is, you know, it's number 35, I believe. Number 1 and 2 were bicycles that they built themselves, that they ride around town, that they ride to work on every single day, Pietras and Zacharias. And they're absolutely amazing human beings. I love them to death. And so you can imagine in the small town where people aren't used to seeing anything made locally, these beautiful bicycles are riding around town and with these guys and with a huge smile on your face. And they have been stopped and asked, even by tourists, where did you get that bike from? And they say, I made it. And people without doubt do not believe them. And that is part of the thing that we are trying to basically change and be like, no, no. Beautiful things can come from places you don't expect them to come from. We haven't arranged it yet because we only started selling bicycles yesterday, but we have planned very much. We will ship the bike to you wherever you are, but what I really want you to do is to come to Namibia and pick it up. And I don't want you to come on your own. I want people to come and pick up their bikes at the same time. So we have pickup festivals. So you all come in and you meet Pietras, you meet Zacharias. You probably have Zacharias' wife sew you some shirts because she makes beautiful dresses and made many of my shirts for me. See the workshop, see the farm. We go for a ride together. Doing that with like-minded people who are all buying the same bike as you, the community that it creates, that is ideal.
Can someone blow the Amazing Road Clear a siren whistle? Go on. Guaranteed to work every time?
Absolutely. They've been making this whistle since the middle of the 19th century. I think they've pretty much perfected it by now.
Is this your main business at Bespoke, selling whistles?
No. No.
What else is it you do?
This was a crazy little COVID project that we ended up doing with Hudson. It's actually the oldest whistle maker in the world. And they make the mechanism and we make the cases around it.
Oh,
and
man.
We just ended up making a few for ourselves and some friends, and then end up, a few people heard about it, and we've sold hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of whistles all over the world. Someone said to me early on that certain products have a soul. That's why classic cars, they have a soul. I think he referred to it as ensoulment, and I really feel that. And when I saw the original Chatelier components, I knew they had the soul of the makers in them. I'm Andy Richman, and I'm the chief executive of Chatelier. Chatelier was founded in 1890 as a maker of frames and bicycle components. They then went on to make motorcycles and cars. And for the first half of the 20th century, they were probably the finest component maker in the world. And they were particularly well known for their crank sets and pedals. So when we decided to revive the company in 2017, obviously we thought we'd start.
When you say
that.
Revive the company, how do you revive the company? Was it defunct? Did you buy it?
Yeah, exactly. So the company had actually gone out of business in the late 1980s, like much of the British cycle industry. And I went down the rabbit hole around 2017 when I rediscovered.
Why?
Why? Because I had a classic bike and I was looking for what components to put on that bike, and I kept hearing this repeated thing, well, if you're going to build that bike up, Andy, you've got to use Chatelier components. And I knew vaguely about the company and the brand, but I didn't know any of the real backstory. And it's just an amazing story.
Give me a part of it. Give me a little bit of that backstory.
Okay, so that they were founded in 1890 by William Chatelier. He actually was one of the earliest winners of the first bicycle race in the world, which was the Catford Hill Climb. He won it, I believe, in 1888, 1889, and 1891. And in 1890, the year he didn't win it, he founded the company.
Right, well, did he blame his chain ring? Is that what happened?
And they went on initially to make components, frames, tandems. In 1903, they started making motorcycles. They had the world land speed record on a 300cc motorcycle.
So you liked and wanted the chainring so much, you just basically bought and revived the company.
Yeah,
right?
So I tracked
the chainring worth it?
Yeah, so making things in the UK is very hard. And, you know, like anything, you have to be a little bit crazy to do something like this. But, yeah, I mean, I just thought, how can this company not exist? And me and a couple of other people, actually a design engineer who at the time was working in Formula One, came together and just said, why don't we remake a pedal inspired by the original pedals that they made. And it all started with that. And the team kind of built up, and we're now making crank sets for modern bikes. And we're just about to launch a new British-made crank set for the Brompton, which we're excited about. And over time, we hope to kind of go end-to-end on the bicycle and begin to remake hubs and brakes and handlebars and seat posts and stems and everything else. The art is really the fact that it's part art and part science. I mean, there is a lot of, obviously, engineering skill that goes into producing these, but there's also still, even with advanced manufacturing, where you think it's just all computer programming, no, it's not. There's still actually, the maker is so important in all of this, and just nuancing it and prototyping it and iterating it and improving it gradually. I mean, we go through so many prototypes just kind of perfecting it, and the tolerances now are so tight for modern cycling components. You really have to be on it. And I mean, it's been I don't come from a manufacturing background. I actually come from a technology software background. It's a whole new world. It's been a huge learning curve for me. But there's incredible skills in the UK. We've kind of tapped into a lot of the kind of like automotive supply chain who work with, you know, the likes of, I don't know, McLaren or Aston Martin and Formula One. There are a lot of that skill and knowledge is there, but it just hasn't been focused on the cycling industry. So we're trying to kind of revive their interest in doing all of that.
You're telling me that you live in the States and you wouldn't do this, or you wouldn't have done this if you didn't live in the States and you weren't sort of looking back misty-eyed towards Britain.
Yeah, I know, that's absolutely right. I mean, it's when you leave the UK and you look back, you forget a lot of things, but certain things just really resonate, like the British countryside, or I don't know how to describe it. It's just certain things that just kind of you really, really, really miss.
And they're often like minute things, aren't they? Really tiny things.
And British manufacturing, I think people, when you're in the UK, you forget how it's viewed in the rest of the world. So people absolutely love British vintage cars. And where I live, there's a huge scene, and I'll go there, and they'll be driving along in anything from MGs to Jensen Interceptors to whatever. And I'll turn up with my British accent, and people just wax lyrical about, you know, British design and engineering and everything else. And I can see, you kind of really struck me. So when looking back, thinking about this, and I stumbled upon this company, I thought, how can this not exist? This is exactly what the UK needs to be doing in 2020. This was in 2017. You know, Brexit was going on. Everyone was talking about we need to bring jobs back to the UK. And this is exactly the kind of thing. And there's been a real renaissance in frame building and in the bike world. But on the component side, very, very little. We thought we want to come back, have both British design and British manufacturing, not just British design. And so we went out there. It's hard to convince people that you're not completely nuts. But we managed to find some amazing people in the supply chain to work with us to do very small quantity production runs. And yeah, I mean, it's hard making things here. It's expensive. We're always about just helping people understand the story of British manufacturing and the importance of making things again in the bike world here in the UK.
This must be the most futuristic sounding bike here. The brand's called Cybro. I want to go find out what it's all about.
We are from the north of Italy. We are from Bassano del Grappa. We are an artisanal brand, and we are playing with the carbon and different material to make special bikes. Yeah, our aesthetics is pretty, how do you say,
it's timeless.
Different.
So the bike that draws me, so I mostly ride fixed gear, and there's a bike behind me that I want to talk about. This is one of the most stunning bikes I've seen here. I sort of do my best to describe it. It has it's a low pro style frame, so with a sloping top tube. The rear wheel has an incredibly deep section with Cybro written on it, which I still think gives off a sort of cyberpunk dystopia vibe, but I love it. At the front, you've got a 5-spoke carbon wheel, and anyone who listens to this show knows that I'm a sucker for a tri-spoke or a 5-spoke, just as long as it's an odd number. And, well, everything's changed since I got into the fixie scene. In my day, and I'm talking sort of 2009, 2010, the trend was to get narrower and narrower handlebars, and you've gone the opposite way. This is the trend, isn't it? The wide handlebars.
It's a bike to enjoy the riding. It's like you want to push, you want to have your force, you want to ride the bike, you want to be into the bike, wide handlebar to push exactly into the curves, but it's like to be also arrogant. Why not to be boo? Come on, look at the shape of the lugs. They are like...
I mean, that's the thing I didn't really describe, is that the seat stays are incredibly low on the seat tube, like incredibly low. It's a stunning bike.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't respect any rules. We just take a geometry that was remembering the laser from Cinelli, the lugs and the concept of the feeling you have from the 90s cycling, because when you ride fixie you want to feel a bike that you feel under your leg, not something that is not that strong, but something that you can push and place in the curve, and when you skid you like it. And this, come on, look at that. You can skid without any, you just jump and boom. You know, I spend a lot of time in the fixie world, and somehow I want every day, and Peter came from the same scene, in so somehow when we design the bike we cannot leave our history. I don't know how to say, but come on, we have road bike, we have mountain bike, we have gravel bike, but how can you forget the where you start? No.
Hey, I was attracted to you because I love crusty metal bikes.
Ah, really?
I've spoken to Duncan, isn't it?
I recognise your voice.
I'm from the cycling podcast.
Yeah, that's why I recognise you.
I'm Tom. Nice to meet you.
Tom, good to meet you, Pete.
Hi, sorry. Pete. Nice to meet you. Right, let's do that one. Yeah. So I think it's Duncan, isn't it, from Crossley?
Duncan. Yeah, he's just.
This is not his stand, though. This is your stand.
So this is my stand. This is Aravis. Aravis bags. So I make bike bags, mainly focused on custom frame bags.
What was your sort of path to doing this?
I basically started making bags for myself, and then for a few friends, and then tried to sell a few, and it's kind of gone from there, really. I do it part-time, but yeah, it's great to be able to come to a show like this and, you know, show what I'm making. And I literally work out of my house, and I'm just based down the road in Walthamstow, so it's nice to, it's a local show for me, and yeah, it's been good.
I knew I was in the right place. You lot listening, you'll know that as well as bikes, one of my other passions is video games, and particularly arcade culture. Have you built this cab and this game for the show?
So the story behind this, Tom, is I make the bags part-time, and my day job is I'm a school teacher. So I teach at a school just down the road from the velodrome here in Leytonstone. And last year with the students, we built two of these arcade machines. And then the children learned how to program their own games to play on them. So I've very kindly borrowed one of the machines for the weekend and rebranded it. And I have programmed a little game called Bike Packers. And the high score this weekend is going to win a custom frame bag made for them.
I've warmed up my game in hand. I'm ready. One hand on the joypad, on the joystick. Let's go. Level one, Escape the City. Well, listeners, I'd love to tell you that I was absolutely awesome at Bike Packers and I smashed the high score. But I've got to say, some outrageous crash detection on that game meant that I only got 197 points. So no free bags for me, but a definite highlight of this boat. It's one thing when you walk around the show, if you notice like a handlebar grip on one of the display tables, that means that the bike is an award winner. And this is an award winner over here from Avalanche Cycles.
We win for the best road bikes.
Wow. And tell us a bit about who you are.
So we are a couple of French frame builders. We are based in Paris, in France. and we work only bespoke bicycle in steel and stainless steel. Before to be a Frambler?
Yeah.
No, we was a product designer. Oh. So we was okay to design and draw some technical objects, but compared to our studies, we lose progressively the workshop part, because when you are a product designer, it's not your job. You just have to visit some workshop, but you don't make the thing. So that's why we choose to change the way of life to create Avalanche, because we have the conception part with technical part and something with a 3D part, and we can go until the end with the fabrication. So for us, it's a perfect match.
The brand here called Eastwood Bikes, and I believe they are named after Clint Eastwood. So I'm going to go and have a showdown with them. Why have you named a bike brand after Clint Eastwood?
Because I was a police officer and retired, and he was a police officer. It's as simple as that. I needed a name.
So what when you say Clint Eastwood, you're really thinking Clint Eastwood, Dirty Harry Clint Eastwood.
Dirty Harry Clint Eastwood, the best film of all time, sorry, but there we go.
Go and head punk, make my frame, I don't know.
Yeah. Oh yeah, you got it, I'm having that one, that's it, that's all over Insta now.
Tell me about Eastwood Bikes then. I was hoping they were connected to Eastwood in Nottinghamshire, but no.
Sorry, no, they're not. Steel frame, Columbus steel tubing, I'm a new builder, so I've not built very many, but I'm hoping that... The show will bring a lot of people around. They seem to like the bikes. Hopefully that will translate into people wanting to buy frames in the future. And obviously steel bikes are where it's at.
I talked to a lot of people here who've sort of had one career before being a bike builder. A lot of those have been in industries where there's sort of transferable skills, you know, design or whatever. Police officer doesn't really sound like that.
No, but prior to that I used to work for Western Helicopters, which is now Leonardo. So that's where the mechanical interest and the background came from. Took 27 years time out, did a bit of coppering, and now it's back to the engineering. I did my course a year or two back with Bicycle Academy, and I wanted to build a bike that I could put road wheels on, talk out with my mates on a Sunday, and the same frame would be big enough so I could fit gravel tyres on to do a bit of off-roading. So it's two bikes in one. And I wanted it for me, to fit me, and made out of steel. Obviously, because it's just an awesome material, and I know that I could make it myself. So hopefully other people sort of would like that. I know it goes against the whole N plus one thing. You need two bikes, you need a road bike and a gravel bike. But, you know, sorry to all the people out there that their wives tell them that you can't have N plus one. But in reality, and obviously being a bit more serious, the frame is designed so it doesn't look silly with road wheels on. You can keep up with everybody on the Peloton on a Sunday, but you can put gravel wheels on it and you use it for commuting or as a winter bike.
Oh, cycling podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
Come here, Drizzy, let me bring the genius out here.
You're not the genius.
No. I just buy bikes. I buy bikes from him. I'm a fan. I came all the way from Belgium because this guy's a legend, bro.
When you say legend, tell me how legendary this guy is.
10 years. Been making bikes for the kids on the street. Like, obviously you can't see the bikes right now on the podcast, but there's bikes, models, he'll grab a bike, throw it in the river, you know, like someone just discard this bike, he'll grab it, he'll see what he can do with it, he'll make it simple and always in the light of a classic bike, you know, he's a classic bike builder, always putting, like, for example, the brakes, all classic style.
It's a little bit of a throwback to the old sort of Junkers days in mountain bike, you know, taking an old frame and throwing it down a Marin County hill. What's the thinking behind the brand? You don't like frames going to waste?
I don't like frames going to waste. I love building frames, but I wouldn't be able to buy like frame jigs or tubes or whatever. So I put some scrap bikes, cut them up, flip the tubes, weld them back together, and then like a whole lot of bike, a whole lot of driving experience. My name is Driss, and I'm from Leuven, Driss Boussif. And my bicycle brand is called BCB, Boussif Custom Bikes.
Who's well, you're a customer, so you've got a few of it. How many of these bikes have you got?
Now we have two. We have
the third in the pipeline.
We have a third in the pipeline. I have like
third five. In the pipeline.
So do you guys come and you ask for a certain, because this obviously you find bikes.
Yeah.
So are you limited by what you find? Or
yeah,
what?
And people come give bike, but the bikes that I use is like the real scrap bikes. It's not like hard to come by. Nobody wants them.
You'll find them in the rivers.
what do you ask for then when you go for a bike?
I went there and I wanted to change a tire with him. And his mate that was working there was like, yo, here we build bikes and we're not changing tires. And I was like, oh yeah.
I was like, you send these cool guys away there. It took months for them to come back, and I was like, oh, and then they came back with instant bromance, right?
Yeah. Wow. And then like I saw his bike. He has one like this green one with the bendy Art Nouveau frame. And I was just like, bro, I haven't seen anything like it. It just looks so mean. It looks like a bull.
Like,
you know?
The chassis. Yeah, oh, I want that chassis.
And I was going on and on. And then, like, yeah, he finally made his bike. And, yeah.
I build bikes for people, no professional, just people who love bikes, want to ride it, shred it through the city. And then I ask you, what do you want? You want a racer? You want a whatever they want?
Bike.
But usually it's like, it's no professional athletes or whatever. Even though this legend, he drove the bike. Like,
I'll hit some good times, man.
Yeah, like, takeaway driver, you know, brother.
Yeah. I do the real fast takeaway deliveries with that one, man.
And you do it without a battery? You don't do an e-bike?
No, man. The battery bikes are too slow. I'll be leaving them on the highway, man. These guys, they just like crushing their hearts, man.
I mean, you could presumably by now, you could have be working, you know, fabricating bikes, you know, buying tubing and doing that stuff.
This guy came up here and came here three times looking for me, like, yeah, I want to take this ID and get it to China, mass produce and commercialize. Ah, no, man, I don't want that. I'm anti that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I just want to have fun, create some cool things for cool people, and that's all there is to it.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
This episode of Service Course is also sponsored by Stitch Fix. Now, I'm not a big one for clothes shopping, if I'm perfectly honest. I don't like traipsing around the shops. I don't like trying things on. And so Stitch Fix has been great for me because you basically leave all of the hard work to an expert stylist who selects five items and sends them to you according to the style guide that you fill out at the beginning when you sign up, and then the information that the stylist gathers from you as you go along. And you can also change stylist if you don't like what you're being sent. But recently I got my first invite to a Christmas party. Party season is coming up very soon, and I was looking through my wardrobe and realizing that not a lot of my more smarter party going outfits fit me anymore, so I'm going to need Stitch Fix to send me a delivery. So I'm looking forward to that arriving. The last Stitch Fix delivery I got had a couple of real gems in it. Very happy with what my stylist picked out for me. Really nice pair of black jeans. And what else did I get? I got a hoodie and a polo shirt last time, which I really like. But I'm looking for something a bit smarter this time. Might be in the market for a jacket. So we shall see what turns up. If you would like to get started, go to stitchfix.co.uk/cycling to set up your profile. And usually you pay a £10 styling fee each time you order, but our friends at Stitch Fix have a special offer for you. Right now, the styling charge for your first order will be waived, giving you the opportunity to try their service completely free of charge. There's no subscription required either, and delivery and returns are easy and free. So if you'd like to get started today with Stitch Fix, go to stitchfix.co.uk/cycling and you'll receive your first fix styled and delivered to you absolutely free. And to sweeten the deal, you'll get an additional 20% off when you keep all five of the items that have been sent in your fix. So that's stitchfix.co.uk/cycling. You've got nothing to lose with Stitch Fix. We'll put those details in the show notes too.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Before I rejoin Lizzie, I just want to say thanks as ever to Science in Sport, who support everything we do here across the Cycling Podcast. And once again, recently I was in one of those supermarkets where things cost a little bit less than other supermarkets, and I saw that usual huddle of semi-pro athletes around the Science in Sport stand, because there were some Science in Sport products there at slightly lower prices than you might find elsewhere. But you don't need to go into a bun fight in a discount supermarket, because you can get 25% off your next Science in Sport order while you're in the comfort of your own home. Just go to scienceinsport.com and enter the offer code SISCP25. That's SISCP25.
Well, I enjoyed that. And on the sort of subject of hand-built bikes, I don't know if you know that I'm a big fan of the fixed gear scene, and the fixed gear scene sort of dovetailed with this other weird niche part of cycling, which was tall bikes, and that's where you weld one frame on top of another to create a tall bike, and you can keep.
Did you weld it yourself?
Listen, I've never been up a tall bike. I'm staying very close to the crowd, but you can keep. In theory, you can keep adding bikes, and some of these are extreme. They get really, really quite tall, to the point where you probably have to duck under a lamppost.
How does that work?
Do you have
a belt drive to the bottom?
That's it. Yeah, I mean, I think you can relay. You can relay cranks, but you can have a belt drive to the bottom as well. Obviously, it gets harder the more frames you add. But on that tip, there is a guy I've been following who is riding around Europe on a tall bike, and I've been following his progress. Very interested. Definitely hoping to bring you some of that in next month's episode if I can. But on that tip, Lizzie, you're also following someone on a slightly different bike, doing a very big trip.
I am indeed. And this is, you know, they are actually a big shout out now to Stevie and Laura Massey-Pugh, who are sending me clips every day from their round the world record breaking tandem ride. And hopefully that will be coming to you sometime next year as probably a number of episodes of Explore. And they have this beautiful custom tandem frame made by Co-Motion Bikes in Oregon with steel from the UK. So the bike has already sort of done the round the world distance from the UK over to Oregon and back again. And the special thing about this frame is that it comes apart into two, which allows Laura and Stevie to perfectly fit it and relatively easily into two standard cardboard bike boxes, which has been absolutely essential for their round the world epic, because they've had to arrange for people to meet them at airports with cardboard boxes, and then they've had to pack it at the airport, because as part of the round the world rules for Guinness, you have to ride to and from the airports. So they'll get to the next airport and then they'll take the bike apart and then put the cardboard in the bin and go on their way.
In the recycling bin, obviously.
The recycling bin, of course. But no, it's a really interesting bike, and they've got a belt drive between the front crank and the rear crank, and they have two belt drives that they're swapping every quarter of the way around the world, so that they wear at the right rate. It's really interesting. You'll be hearing a lot more from them next year, but currently they're in Regina in Canada. They're absolutely flying, and they're hoping to make their 180 day target back to Berlin. So go and follow them, cheer them on, donate to them if you can, because they're funding all of this through, well, themselves and sponsors and crowdfunding. And I think it's Stella, STELA tandem over on Facebook and Instagram. So go and check them out and give them your support. And go on, Stevie and Laura, you're doing a really great job. It's amazing following the progress.
How are they, sort of doing accommodation and stuff? Is there a degree of bike packing to this as well?
Oh, well, it's fascinating, Tom. So I listen to their updates every day or every time that they have Wi-Fi and can send them through. And generally speaking, they are trying to stay, indoors when they can, because it saves them so much time with, putting the tent up, putting the tent down. They'll get
also
a better night's sleep.
There are bears in Canada, aren't there? So,
there are bears.
There are bears. There are definitely bears.
Yeah. And it was interesting. I think it was in India. They couldn't ride at night because the elephants came on the road, and the risk of injury from an elephant was so high. So it's been absolutely fascinating to follow. But no, generally speaking, they've been trying to stay indoors. But
you do get a good draft off an elephant, though, Lizzie. Hell of a draft, honestly.
But the average speed is quite low. But no, there have been many, many instances where they've arrived at a roadhouse in the middle of Australia, and it's been closed, and the next one's another 100 miles up the road, and then they've had to camp in the bush. So it's really been fascinating following their progress, and I'm sure you'll hear a lot more from them next year, but please do go and cheer them on in the meantime.
We should do that, Lizzie, you and I.
I'll go on the front and do the pedaling, and you can record the podcast in the back.
Just do some production. Look out for elephants. Be all right. I could be on a tall bike at the back, so I've got a good, great view over there.
Oh, well, I don't think we're going to beat their record, Tom, because, I mean, they've been averaging 100 miles a day or something. Maybe we can do a tall bike around the world record.
No one's done a world record for a tandem tall bike, I don't think. So there you go. I'm just saying, put a pin in that for 2023, you know, when the season finishes.
Okay.
Post Worlds or something, and then we'll go. We'll head off. I'm doing it. I said,
okay, I mean, you're not holding me to that, but okay.
All right, Lizzie, well, listen, I will let you go. And I'm going to, in terms of dot watching, then where do we go for the dot watching? Because I'm going to go and head there now and have a look.
Well, head over to stellatandem.com. That's stellatandem.com for all the information about their round the world record attempt.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.